Afternoon, we're with Brian Kennedy. Thank you for, first of all, thank you for applying. Thank you for your service. That's very apparent in the application you filled out. And thank you for coming in today to discuss with us for the next 45 minutes why you would be a contributor to the Board of Regents and other pertinent thoughts. As part of the process, we're going to ask a series of questions. Those questions tend to be spontaneous on our part, but we'll take care of the questions. Okay. But as we get started, I ask you to make an opening statement if you would like, and then we'll go through the questioning period. As we get near the end of the questioning period, I will try to give you some sort of notice that we're maybe on the last question or two, and then I'll ask you to make the closing statement.
All right,
so floor is yours.
All right, thanks, Pat. Thank you, members of the commission. My name is Ryan Kennedy. I'm applying to be the student regent. I guess just for my opening statement, I'd like to go back. My love for the University of Minnesota is very deep-rooted. I'm originally from Bemidji, Minnesota, kind of growing up there, a community where maybe more than others in our state, not a lot of people go on to pursue higher education. Neither of my parents went to college. They both went to the Navy where they met, and then they moved back, got married in Hawaii, and moved back up here to Bemidji. Why exactly, I'm not sure, but I've been able to kind of benefit from that. And so growing up, you know, my first kind of exposure to the University of Minnesota was, you know, through the sports teams. You know, seeing the 96 Final Four team, which may or may not have existed, depending on the records, you know, seeing that as an elementary school student, and just, you know, that was kind of how I had initially gotten involved at that young age. And my parents were, despite not having gone to college themselves, had always instilled in me that I was going to college. And, you know, for me, as someone growing up in northern Minnesota, you know, the University of Minnesota was the college. It was where I wanted to go. And, you know, I moved down to the suburbs, Rogers, Minnesota, in high school and middle school. And kind of as I went through school there and really did well, I started looking at, you know, some of the other schools, you know, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, you know, schools like that. But I actually got hooked on the University of Minnesota at a relatively young age. At 11, I enrolled at the University of Minnesota Talented Youth Math Program. So in the seventh grade, in 2001, I started taking classes here every week, sometimes twice a week. And so I started commuting down here with my mom after school. And, you know, as an 11-year-old, seeing this campus, having only been at my elementary schools and middle schools and high schools, it was, I mean, awe-inspiring. It was enormous. But it was something that I grew very used to and very accustomed to pretty early. I know a lot of people were afraid, just going through school, afraid to come to the University of Minnesota because it was so large. But ever since at a young age, it's felt very close and very, very much like home to me. So I went through that program for 3 years, had about a two-year break where I did the 10th and 11th grades, and then for my senior year of high school, I wasn't feeling very challenged by my curriculum there. And so I found out about an opportunity to become a PSEO student, post-secondary enrollment options, and basically got to get a full-time year at the University of Minnesota done when I was still in high school, which was, you know, I loved it because it was really challenging me, but my parents loved it because, you know, it saved a lot of money. It was, you know, the money that was going to my high school instead kind of got deferred to the University of Minnesota. And so that was a great opportunity for me to really get that education, you know, at an affordable, basically nothing. And from there, that was my senior year of high school, and so I started looking at, again, other colleges. And finally, the choice for me came down to the University of Minnesota and Johns Hopkins. And I chose the University of Minnesota. And it was absolutely because, 90% of because of my love and my experience for it, and 10% because of, you know, I could get out of there at about 1/20th of the cost that I could have at the other school. And for me, I didn't really feel like the challenges or the educational opportunities I was going to be offered were going to be any different because I knew how much the University of Minnesota offered. I had seen it firsthand. And so I continued on as an undergrad student and have been there for the last 6 years out of high school now, starting as an undergrad student, getting out Then going over to the Humphrey School, starting my master's in public policy, and then deciding that I wanted to tack on the JD as well and go on to law school. And so just as experience as a student, I've been going to the University of Minnesota for a really long time, and that it has really kind of helped me further my love and appreciation for the role the University of Minnesota has in our state, not just for higher education, but for our state as a whole. And once I kind of got there at 17, I was out of high school. I finally started living down here instead of commuting as I did for many years. And I got involved in, kind of community organizing and campus organizing to try to make the university a better place. I saw a lot of other students come in with just astronomical student loans, even on the front end, before they were even entering the University of Minnesota. And that was something that, for me, as someone who is fortunate enough to kind of, with post-secondary and AP credits and the such, was able to get to the University of Minnesota and not have so much debt hanging over me. And so that was something that I kind of took as a responsibility and an obligation to work to kind of lesser that burden for other students. So I started getting involved, student government, campus organizing, started with the undergraduate student government. Quickly, my second year, I was chair of the Student Senate, which is the overarching student government that represents students at all of the University of Minnesota campuses. There, I got to work very closely with the Faculty Senate and the University Senate to kind of craft policies for the university as a whole and to evaluate policy proposals as they came forth. That's kind of the institutional governance structure for the university. But at the same time, I was working on the executive board of the undergraduate student government. A year later, I ran what was then called the Legislative Certificate Program, has then now been the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition.
I've got that right.
Yeah, okay. We've got some MSLC students back there. And so I ran that program in 2009, taught students how to lobby, developed a curriculum on how to lobby on higher education issues, on affordable higher education issues, and on how to bring the student voice to the Capitol. From there, I was president of the graduate student government, which is, I believe, still the largest graduate professional student government in the country, and was able to really coordinate not only on legislative and student affair issues here, but also with other graduate professional student governments to kind of coordinate national lobbying efforts. And the same time I was doing that, I was the student that was selected to serve on the Presidential Search Advisory Committee that went out and found and selected President Kaler. Much of that credit is due to other people than me, but it was a great experience, and just being able to kind of shift from that role of primarily student advocacy and, pushing kind of the student line and what was best for students to really kind of take a holistic approach and start looking at the university and how, the student interest interacts with all the other interests at play, faculty, employees, as well as university administration, and then the community as well. So that was kind of a great experience for me to kind of start shifting towards what I expect the Board of Regents role is more of, and not so much, at least the student regent role, not so much pushing the student line on every issue, but looking at how students are kind of a holistic part of the university and how we can fit into all the initiatives, not just education, but how we can bring students into all of our other efforts, including our research initiatives and working with other institutions in the state to kind of better the state as a whole, where the university can play a part in that. So that's my opening statement. That's the kind of the experience I have and kind of what has brought me here today. And I would love to answer any questions that you all might have. Thank you.
Thanks. Lois?
Am I first on the list? Okay. Sorry, I thought I was just raising my hand.
Well, I happened to. It was all about timing.
Thank you very much. Would like to go to the point which you were just concluding, and that's that service on the Board of Regents isn't at all about advocacy, but it's about comprehensive governance and looking forward. Mm-hmm. And you referenced talented youth math program, familiar with it. And so against that backdrop, you have gone forward into significant career of public advocacy thus far. But I would wager, and it's just a wager, that several of your math classmates might have gone into the computer science and IT and digital technology areas. That being the case, in the governance looking forward aspect of what the University Board of Regents needs to assess on behalf of the citizens of the state, looking at MOOC and MIT and John Hopkins and Stanford open courseware and the like that is taking place and growing on a daily basis. What do you see as the implications of that technology-driven change that is on a pretty fast-paced development scale across the board towards traditional higher education, and in particular, how might you, as a sitting regent, address that issue for the University of Minnesota?
Sure. Thank you. So just, I was actually, when I started at the University of Minnesota, a biomedical engineering major. I was biomedical engineering and political science, and so I got a little bit down the path of that engineering coursework, but found my calling elsewhere. My brother is a computer science major at UMD, though. And so we have seen, just even in the last 5 years, since I've started working on these issues, the development of the technology, both with open courseware, open textbooks, as well as, you know, kind of the interactive teaching styles, I think it is opening up a lot of doors for us, and it's going to be we don't know how it's going to play out yet. So my thoughts on it generally are open textbooks have something that I've been advocating for a long time, especially for our larger courses. When we're talking about, you know, Calculus 1 or, you know, Econ 1101, where we're teaching it to 500-600 students per lecture section, these are also subjects that the subject matter isn't changing very frequently. Yet, a lot of times with the publishers, we will get new editions every 2 or 3 years because that's their business model. That's how they stay in business. Unfortunately, it's not necessarily the best solution for us, for students, for faculty. and so I think that open textbooks is something that we should move towards as for our larger courses. I think that we should have hopefully we can start developing some national standards for, you know, how often these things need to be reviewed and what constitutes a major change that would need to kind of go out to different students and for our different courses to change. But that's the great thing about open textbooks a lot of times is that they're available digitally. And those revision costs aren't reflected by having to go out and buy, you know, a new $120 textbook, where if you were just using the old edition, you could buy it off someone who just took the class for $20. So I think that that's something that we could move towards. Also, us utilizing that open courseware, I think, is something that could be huge. Obviously, it's not something that I think the university as a whole would be interested in developing it as in developing their own content, just because of, you know, because hopefully in other rooms across the country, people would then be talking about the University of Minnesota open courseware, as opposed to kind of our MIT, Stanford, Harvard. And I think that that's a great opportunity for us. Obviously, using those resources in our classrooms might be more difficult, but I certainly see a route for student groups and other, you know, kind of bodies on campus to say, well, hey, you know, all you political science majors that may have an interest in engineering or might be more interested in going to that type of policy, but, you know, don't necessarily have the science background, here, let's go and have our own kind of classwork on the side that goes off of, say, those open courses. Or maybe having, you know, professors that would kind of, you know, come once a month and kind of do guest lectures off of some of this open course material that wouldn't necessarily need to be facilitated by the university, but could be facilitated by the students. That being said, I mean, I think overall what the regions need to do in the next 5, 10, 15 years is keep an eye out and just watch these different technologies, these different methods develop, and start figuring out which ones can be most useful in the classroom. I think our College of Continuing Education and Development is issuing iPads to like incoming classes of students. I think it's only in certain programs, but let's evaluate that. Let's look at how that has changed their instruction methods, you know, over a 5-year time span, and say, is it something that we want to, you know, start expanding to other, you know, other graduate programs? Is it something that we want to try at the undergraduate level? You know, is it something that we have alternative options available for students? You know, you can have a supplemental open, you know, open textbook that, you know, we might have assigned readings on, or, you know, there might be handouts from, but, you know, we still feel that we need an actual, you know, text that the professor has been using. So I think that that's going to be key, is just watching how these things develop, watching what is working, what not. But also on the open courseware side, I think we really should move quickly in developing our own content. Find our niche, find, you know, whether that coordinates with the, you know, the Minnesota Drive initiative, or we're looking at, you know, okay, maybe...
Four fields.
Yeah, right. So instead of, you know, okay, well, maybe Harvard and MIT have economics and, you know, calculus down, but does anyone have, you know, food economy, you know, or is anyone having robotics? You know, those types of things that I think could go hand in hand with those types of research initiatives.
George?
Mr. Kennedy, excuse me, my question has to do strictly with your application. You had said in the opening statement that you were applying for the student at large position.
Correct.
And on your application, you checked all three positions.
Yep.
Is there one that you prefer over the others when you said you're applying for the student position?
Sure. I mean, just from the nature of the what's open and what's not right now, I am eligible for all positions, as I understand it, the at-large positions. I live in the 5th Congressional District. So I figured I would keep my options open, especially knowing 6 years ago there were two students selected, one for the student position and one in the 5th Congressional District spot.
I understand. I just wanted to clarify that for myself. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Paul.
Ryan, I want to thank you for your service as a member of the search committee to bring a new president to the University of Minnesota. I've had the privilege of working with him, and you folks did a good job.
Thank you.
So I want to ask you what you learned in that particular experience that has helped you become better informed to be the elected student regent on the Board of Regents.
That's a great question. I think that a large part of it for me had to do with moving out of kind of a leadership, you know, kind of chair of a committee or chair of a board role into a, you know, participatory role. So where normally a lot of my experience had been, you know, managing personalities and trying to, you know, move conversations forward and make sure that, you know, points were articulated on both sides of an argument before, you know, a body came to a consensus. For me, this was more of, you know, letting Regent Simmons do her amazing facilitating work and being able to just kind of sit back and really digest what everyone else was saying, how other comments and how other people's interests were interrelated and how they kind of came together to advance, you know, how everyone's different perspectives on that search committee kind of came together to form, you know, a cohesive vision of what we wanted to see in a president and how that interacted with, you know, the guidelines that the Board of Regents themselves had set forth for finding a presidential candidate. And so, you know, for me, it was really about finding the issues where my personal experience, I felt I had something to add to the conversation and where I could help, you know, kind of move the conversation along and kind of add in points where maybe other people where I'd seen that, you know, because of my experience, I'm seeing the situation from a certain way where others might be, you know, that committee was heavily faculty as well as, you know, Regent Simmons and a couple other people, but certainly I was the only student and had a very unique voice, I think, to add to the conversation. And so that was interesting for me in terms of the actual regents. We were working off of a regent kind of mandate. We were told to find a presidential candidate or candidates with a certain set of characteristics and For me, that was interesting in the sense that I had never been in this situation before where, you know, everything was subject to, say, you know, open meeting laws. And, you know, that was a whole new process for me as well that I was able to get comfortable with, and knowing that we're speaking with one voice and it's not my voice. And so, you know, to outside of committee meetings, to just kind of know my role and know that my input belongs and is valued at the committee stage, and knowing that, you know, never feeling the need or knowing that, you know, going outside or around that committee to the media was something you absolutely wouldn't do.
If we were to ask Regent and Chair of the Search Committee Simmons, mm-hmm. to tell us about your role in a few words, what do you think she would say?
Hopefully she would say what I just said, but very concisely. I think that she would say that I was very participatory, would seek to clarify uncertain or ambiguous statements from other members, just to get a better gauge of where they were coming from, and just someone that, you know, would try to provide input where I thought that it was needed.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Period.
I'm interested in how you approach problem solving, mm-hmm. and preparation. So I'm going to go back to the open courseware concept, and assuming that you were going to have a robust discussion around this, assuming that the perception was that it was becoming a viable threat to revenue to the university.
Sure.
If, in fact, people could receive credit for it. Mm-hmm. And actually, I also want to mention there was an article that came out this morning around people being able to take classes through some of these organizations and receive certificates for $90 or $100. Mm-hmm. And so one of the dynamics of this is there a risk in terms of, in your mind, is there a risk in terms of negating the value of a college education? If you can gain the same knowledge, and that's a big if, mm-hmm. Through taking these classes and then getting a certification versus having to pay the full tuition ride.
Right.
So that's, you know, there are a lot of different factors that play into this. So I'm interested in how you would approach really this analysis and discussion.
Mm-hmm. Just real quick question. Was the certification, was that coming not from the University of Minnesota but from other organizations?
So if you took an online course, an open course through Harvard, you might be able to pay $90 or $100 or $125 to get a certificate saying that you passed econ whatever.
Right. Okay. Just general approach to problem solving, I guess I would try to take a potential problem and turn it into something that could benefit us. I think that trends towards open courseware and kind of online delivery of higher education materials is, I don't know if we can roll that back or if we'd even want to. I think that instead we should look at, it really is where the trends are going, and look at a way for us to distinguish that open courseware material that we provide in a way that, you know, that it is worth it for the payment. And maybe that does mean, you know, it's a discounted tuition for, you know, taking a course online, which really it should be, given that instructional costs would be significantly lower. I think that would be a way that we could still, you know, kind of have that avenue open to people, but at the same time, not feel like we're competing with, you know, Harvard's, you know, getting one certificate for a class, or going and, you know, I remember a couple years ago, my grandma, who doesn't have a college education but worked for, you know, the county transportation department up in Beltrami County for 40 years. She went on Phoenix Online, typed in her amount of work experience, and they said, well, for $300, we'll just send you a degree. It's like, oh, okay. There's no coursework involved. It was, you know, those are the things that I really think we need to be trying to, like, distinguish ourselves from, in saying that if we do want to offer these kind of, you know, one-off certification courses, I think that's a way where we're kind of almost getting into a whole new kind of market of higher education students, people that are trying to get, you know, just one class. It's, you know, it's almost like what our continuing education is now, but just with much better delivery and you know, really reaching or the ability to reach that market at a much wider level. Sorry, was that answering your question? Or
let me ask it a little bit of
a
different way, and that's very good information and some great solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested in how you would prepare for that conversation.
Sure. Yeah, so I think that what I would do is look into what type of programs are out there. Find out, you know, which schools are providing these, you know, these one-class certification courses and which ones are, you know, are, well, you have to take, you know, 30 courses in order to get this online degree versus here's an online certification course. I'd really find out the ins and outs of how that's working, what we're doing already, how those programs have worked, how they haven't, you know, maybe what faculty and what students at the University of Minnesota are looking into that. We got, you know, 50,000 students and other, you know, I want to say 20,000 faculty, researchers, staff. We're going to have several people looking into how this works. And I mean, I know some PhD students already that are looking into how to best kind of deliver this information and how, and I think so it's important to touch into the information we've already had and make sure that that gets translated into knowledge at the Board of Regents level. I think that's critically important. And I think that, you know, we need to figure out at the same time in that conversation how that ties into our broader goals, you know, how that does tie into our drive for innovation and for greater research, how that ties into our goals of, you know, providing better, higher quality undergraduate education, how it, you know, ties into our goals of connecting with other organizations in the state. And so I think that that's how I would approach the conversation, is just collect as much information as possible and then kind of, you know, apply the frame of our mission, our vision, the projects that we have going on to figure out, you know, how we can manage all of that in unison.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, Ryan, I'm really interested in, first of all, you've done an amazing job lobbying the legislature on student debt issues, and I actually come from the college access world, too,
yeah.
And dealing with equity and access to higher education. But I wanted to see if you could walk us through your role as a regent mm-hmm. and addressing tuition issues, and basically I'm getting at what's the difference between your role as an advocate and then transitioning to a role of governance.
Sure.
How do you see yourself in that role?
Absolutely. I think one of, I first met Regent Maureen Ramirez in the fall of 2007, and that's actually when I first learned about this position and became interested in this position. Unfortunately, it was the first year of a six-year term, so I had a while to wait. But she came and spoke to the undergraduate student government. She came, and it was kind of a two-way conversation, both updates on what was happening from the regents, but also getting input from the student government as to how, you know, student debt issues were affecting students, what students thought could be done about these issues, and how students wanted to kind of see her fulfill her role at the Board of Regents. I think that that is one key component and something that I would kind of hope and seek to really expand upon, you know, speaking not only to student governments but student groups, individual students that are and faculty that are working on, you know, working on debt and working on access issues, acting as a facilitator, really for, you know, students that are interested or that I, you know, would come across that have great stories to tell or, you know, great experiences and want to get involved, helping them kind of figure out, you know, the best route for them to kind of make change on campus. And I think that that is one role where the student regent can kind of act as an advocate, not necessarily on the board, but in the community and with the students. Our student governance structure isn't the most, it's disjointed. We have, you know, undergraduate and graduate student governments, we have the student senate, we have college boards and individual department student governments as well in some cases. And I think that bringing them together, bringing their voices together, as well as the voices of individual students, student groups that work on debt issues, I think is a role that could really be filled by the student regent. I think Regent Ramirez has done a pretty good job of doing that. And so, I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question?
Well, just how, I mean, you're not going to be an advocate,
right,
per se, you're part of this body,
mm-hmm.
so how do you see yourself kind of bringing that issue, what's the art of doing that through a governance structure?
Sure.
Bringing those issues up.
Yeah, so, I think that, you know, also using that as well to kind of show and demonstrate student support for issues so that when it, in the Board of Regents, you know, I might not say, well, I'm the student regent and, you know, I really think that therefore it needs to go this way, but to say, you know, trying to speak as in part as a voice of the students and say, this is the impact that it will have, this isn't the impact that a particular decision will have on students, and, you know, here that they've been informed of it and they've spoken, and at least present the student to the extent that it's, you know, pretty unanimous, the student opinions on particular issues. At the same time, I also think the Capitol is a great route for the Regents in to the extent that it kind of conforms with what the Regents as a whole would like to see for their kind of Capitol strategy. I know I've been here years before, and we've seen Regents testify, seen Regents in the audience, seen Regents go and speak to particular legislators. That's something that I do have experience with, like you said, and something that I would be excited and eager to do as the student regent if, you know, that was something that the rest of the Regents felt was an appropriate role.
Margaret.
Whenever you're in a position of leadership, mm-hmm. achievements are apparent. You can see it, other people can see it. But the flip side of that, it also shows up weaknesses or areas for improvement.
Yep.
So as you think about yourself and the leadership that you've had, is there an incident where you ruffle feathers, where you were on one side of the fence looking at everybody else on the other side of the fence? Mm-hmm. What happened, and what have you learned yourself from that experience?
Sure. Now, is this just internal in an organization?
I'm talking specifically you.
Okay.
I'm talking about you personally. You've had a lot of leadership experiences. Has anything not worked that well?
Sure.
That if you could rewind the video and re-edit the video, what happened?
Sure.
And what did you learn?
One of the kind of the board leadership experiences I've had is I was the served 3.5 years on the board of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, MPIRG, which is a, you know, student advocacy organization. When I was chair of the board there, this was the year after I had just spent basically an entire internship, an entire legislative session pushing a piece of legislation here that was focused on student debt relief, Opportunity Minnesota. I think I might have mentioned it in my application. Mm-hmm. We got to the next year and the board meeting where we were deciding our legislative priorities for the year. Well, not everyone in the organization, not everyone on the board felt that, you know, I had kind of brought affordable higher education to the organization. I said, mm-hmm. we're organizing with college students. You know, student debt is a big issue that might not have been around in the history of the organization, but it's a big issue now, and I want to see us work on it. And so I had done some considerable work to get that going, and then the next year, as I was board chair, realized the rest of the board wasn't really with me. They wanted, you know, more of the focus on environmental and, healthcare work, and I was kind of on the outside looking in for my own board saying, okay, I'm, you know, one of two people on a 19-member board that want to make, you know, student debt a legislative priority. And it was something, you know, The thing that I would go back and rewind is I think I made my point a little bit too hard and probably used my position of leadership to kind of try to, you know, bring other people extensively, you know, kind of dominate the conversation to try to say, no, look, these are the reasons why we need this. And it was something that in retrospect, you know, I should have done more work before the board meeting to figure out where everybody was at. It was kind of a surprise to me, which is part of the reason I was caught off guard. And so it was something I should have done more prep work before the board meeting to figure out where everybody was at and, you know, where everyone was walking into the room. And at the same time, it was something where I should have realized earlier on that, I personally had many outlets for, you know, trying to get this work done, and it didn't necessarily need to be this organization, and that this organization, you know, the position of the organization needed to reflect that board. And just because I was the chair of the board didn't necessarily mean that, I got to set legislative priorities myself. And so I think that that was one big thing that I would kind of go back and change, you know, if I were able to do it over again. Luckily, it has worked out for me in the long term. I've slowly got the, you know, from the outside, after I left the board, got the organization to work on these again, and actually they'll be looking at introducing it this session. So it took probably 3 years longer than I would have hoped it to, but, you know, the organization is back on the issue now.
I appreciate that teachable moment. I think it's important for young and old.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Ryan, I'm wondering if you could tell us what specific skill sets you possess right now that will lend themselves to helping steer the ship of the university. That is, in terms of governance, in terms of its budget responsibilities, in terms of oversight of the administration, in terms of forming policy. What specific skill sets you possess right now that will help in that endeavor, and how will you use them?
Sure.
Ryan, we may be nearing the end of our this may be the last question.
I'll try to keep it concise. I think one in particular that is very pertinent to the Board of Regents is I have experience reading and, well, in many cases preparing, you know, board packets. That's something that, you know, I've seen the packets for the Board of Regents, and to be honest, I don't have experience with anything quite that big. But, you know, going through, that's something I do have experience with, is preparing for board meetings and, you know, reading the materials, going through, getting a thought on conversations before they happen, and also kind of thinking about, you know, what other work I might need to do between getting the materials and, you know, actually sitting in the meeting. That's a big one. But even more so, going from my master's in public policy, concentrations in nonprofit leadership and management, you know, organizational policy or organizational finance, you know, things that I both have, that I have experience with, even if I don't have firsthand experience with an organization whose budget, you know, is in the billions, you know, I certainly do have experience going through organizational budgets, both firsthand and in, you know, in the classroom setting. As well as, I think, really an eye for detail. An eye for detail in policy making, in drafting policy, in, you know, I'm someone that's going to go through and read a policy proposal, even if it's 30, 40 pages long, you know, provision by provision, line by line, and look for ways that we can improve upon it and look for ways to make it better. At the same time, I recognize that going into this position, we're going to have very thorough, there will be a lot of work put in before that even gets to my desk. But on top of all of that, I'd say strategic, kind of an ability to look at an organization strategically and kind of long-term, and how individual actions can tie in and further those broader goals. I think that's crucial. I think that, you know, if you have a strategic plan, if you have a mission, if you have a vision, it doesn't mean anything unless your individual actions are kind of lining up to help the organization as a whole move in that direction. And so I think that that's something that I have a particular knack for, asking the question, okay, how does this get us, you know, to our goal here? And I think that that's something I kind of bring to the table, is kind of keeping a focus on how each of our decisions is helping move the organization forward.
Jim has promised a quick question.
I asked for a short question, and therefore you can give a short answer.
Absolutely.
Having served on the Presidential Selection Committee, and therefore I presume been a supporter of Dr. Kaler's selection, how would that, might it adversely affect your ability to independently judge his work product and his role?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would hope not. I think that I was able, I had quite a bit of experience working with President Brunix before. So I kind of have a little bit of experience being able to kind of step back. And he was someone that I really liked personally. But I did still, you know, find the ability to kind of step back and look at things objectively and, at the time, in the role of an advocate, sometimes criticize as needed. In the role of Board of Regents, I think that that would be more of a, you know, concerns about President Kaler would obviously be kept private and within the board, but I don't think I would have a problem doing that. Thanks.
two more council members that had questions in the queue, so to speak. Joanne, is your question, would you like to ask it?
Yes, I would. Yeah. I'd like to talk about alignment. Okay. In one of your responses, you talked about what the critical issues were facing the University of Minnesota as it related to tuition and issues of technology. But then you took it further and talked about how the University of Minnesota can play a role in working with other entities, nonprofits, business sector, to work on more pressing issues facing Minnesota.
Right.
So I'd like to know, from a policy standpoint, what are those pressing issues? How do you see that as a policy, and how does that align right now with what you see is happening with the University of Minnesota?
Sure, absolutely. I think some of those were hit on, one of them at least, kind of conservation efforts was hit on in the Minnesota Drive kind of policy proposal from President Kaler. I think that's one way is connecting our researchers into some of these pressing issues. I think, just to name some of them, kind of the future of energy in our state, as we kind of move to kind of hit our renewable energy portfolio standards and beyond, looking at how the University of Minnesota can help, local businesses as well as nonprofits kind of move our energy sector forward in the state. Healthcare delivery, I think, is huge. I think that that's something that if we can, the more efficient we can make that and the broader we can get our healthcare coverage. And in the past couple of years, the state has rolled back a little bit some of our healthcare coverage and kind of moving back to say, okay, is there a way that we can do this more efficiently so that we can provide healthcare, quality healthcare, to more people with the same amount of money? Basically, a lot of solutions to our state's problems could be fixed by state appropriations. And I think that the university's role is figuring out, are there ways around that? Because our legislature over the past 10, 15 years hasn't really necessarily done the appropriations to meet up with some of our needs, or at least some of the needs we have had identified to keep the programs up. And so I think that part of the role of the university could be figuring out, how do we make better government programs? How do we improve and innovate on the technology side of things to lower other costs, so that we can kind of have better delivery of government services? Did that answer your question? Or
That's close. Have you ever registered as a lobbyist?
No.
Okay.
Good question. Jerry, you're the last one on my list. Are you?
Actually, Jim asked a question that's closest to my
brain.
Thank
so you.
I pass.
Thank you, and it'll keep us closer on schedule. So we're at the point where I invite you to make a closing comment. But before you do, as you were preparing for this, I'm sure you were thinking, what questions are they going to ask us?
Yeah.
Is there a question that you thought we maybe should have asked, or is there a glaring issue that we didn't cover that you would like to comment on, and then please just move right into your closing comments?
I don't know that there is a particular area between the written questionnaire and the questions today. I think that I think that the committee did a great job. The one thing that I would maybe add is just in terms of, specific solutions to some of the problems that students are facing. And I think that, I touched on it earlier. I think the legislature is a great place not only for us to come and advocate for appropriations, but also for some of these policy solutions. And I think that President Kaler has done a great job of incorporating those into his proposal this year and really framing the conversation from the front end so that we're not playing catch up, that the conversation is happening on our terms in terms of a tuition freeze for an additional, $42 million increase, which, again, isn't that much if you think about it. It's the exact same amount we were getting in 2001. And so I think that the student regent position, and I think what I could bring to the student regent position, is the ability to kind of innovate some of these policy solutions. With my public policy background, the law school background, but as well as even before that, coming in lobbying on affordable higher education issues. I have lobbied. I haven't registered as a lobbyist. But that includes the Opportunity Minnesota program that I kind of put forth in 2009. As you might have read, I can't remember how much space I had in my questionnaire to include it, but it was something that, we looked out and saw a problem of student debt and said, let's try to find an innovative way to fix it. And we saw the program. I looked at programs from Georgia and Florida and to California, and finally found the one in Maine that said, by kind of having a tax credit for student loan payments and, allowing businesses to claim that credit if they provide tuition favorable benefits to people coming out of college. That's a way that, you know, that it really works out, and we can pitch it as something that pays for itself in the long run, because the economic analysis in Maine said it would, and hopefully our economic analysis here, once it's done, will as well. So that's just something that I feel like I bring to the table. And in terms of a closing statement, I just wanted to thank you all for the time that you put into this. I know that this is your commitment to this goes much beyond my, you know, hours put into that and 45 minutes here. You guys be doing this for a while. So I appreciate that, and just look forward to, I know there's a lot of great candidates, and so I know that, you know, the four regions that we're going to have coming out by the end of this process are going to be great no matter what. So I just wanted to thank you all for your work, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
Thank you for the interview.